Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Tom.
Hello, Russ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And no new dinosaurs. No. Nope. Gotta tell your boys to get their duffing gear and get some more dinosaurs up there. We miss the extending range of dinosaurs behind you.
I'll let them know.
And today we're joined by Matt Dugan, who is in where, Matt, did you say Copenhagen? Is that what you said?
I am in Copenhagen, Denmark.
Literally in Copenhagen or outside of Copenhagen?
I am literally in Copenhagen.
Wow.
About a 20-minute bike ride from downtown. 15-minute bike ride, yeah. But we'll be a metro station in 2022.
Okay, cool. I don't think I've ever been to Copenhagen. I've been to many other places up in that area. I've been to Greenland, Iceland, and a couple of places, Mold and other places in Norway and stuff. But I don't think I've ever been to Denmark.
Norway is definitely the more beautiful of the Scandinavian. If you like mountains and rivers, and there's only one mountain in Denmark, it's very small. It's like a 45-minute hike up, barely elevated above, more of Ohio energy.
Yeah, more of a hill.
Yeah, more of a hill.
But they call it a mountain because you got nothing higher. So, you know, that's the...
By contrast, right? It's just about the difference in the landscape.
That's exactly right. So you wrote this article about development IT, and I'm always off on this thing about, even if you're doing DevOps, you need to learn coding principles, but you don't really need to be a full-on coder. That's not, your job is not to be a full-on coder. And you start out with a really interesting question where you talk about how the number of times you've been asked, why doesn't my application work?
Yeah, I think that the inspiration for this just came from, you know, I've been putting together a DevOps team here in Copenhagen. You know, some of the principles of DevOps are a little bit not as well entrenched in Europe. So we're trying to sort of bring that here. And it sort of became a perennial theme among the folks that I was talking to that, like, you know, they had a lot of questions. How much of my responsibility is debugging applications? How much time do I need to spend sort of working at code compiling and stuff? And sort of it kicked off this whole conversation, sort of a meetup here that was like, how much of your guys' time is spent debugging applications? And I was really surprised by the answer.
Yeah. In fact, for anybody who works in the coding world, I mean, which I will work a lot with coders, the amount of time that you as a coder spend, or coders in general, people who are full-time programmers in general, spend debugging software is probably 2 to 3 times the amount of time they spend actually writing code. It may even be more. Because the one thing you have to realize is that you just can't go code something. You have to understand the existing code, which can take days worth of work trying to understand what is in the code already. So from there, I mean, where did you go with that from a DevOps perspective as far as troubleshooting?
Well, I think that the DevOps perspective is really interesting to me because historically speaking, my background is sort of as a sysadmin. And in the old style of running a physical data center, there was a clear demarcation between the different responsibilities. You know, if I was on a network team, right, there was very little chance that I was going to be a part of like your application debugging session, right? If you could open up a TCP socket and receive back, you know, if the handshake was successful, then the networking team's work is done. And I think that as with DevOps and with modern cloud infrastructure, right, as we sort of utilize more of those services and they become more intrinsic to how applications function, there's been this sort of muddling of the water, which is fine and great, right? We want developers and operations and DevOps to be working in close, working together and really taking advantage of these services and assets. But I've noticed over the last like 3 or 4 years, this sort of shift where a lot of the conversation has started to become like, why am I encountering these problems? You know, if the CI/CD system returns an error, your team owns that error, right? And that sort of has been in some respects, almost a generational shift as I've sort of worked and my career has progressed, I think. And sort of I spend part of the article sort of speculating as to why from there.
Yeah, so it's interesting you bring up this point that developers will often come to you and say, this application worked in my test environment, but I put it on the real network and it doesn't work. And they want you to troubleshoot or explain why that is. And so I do an actual presentation for people who are in CompSci in a college here in California. I do this presentation almost every year for them. It's a senior graduating class at a bachelor's level. And I do this thing about, as a network engineer, what do I want you as an application developer to know about networks? Because they just don't know. They don't know anything about networks. They just assume that it's like talking across the PCI bus in their computer is talking across a network. And it's really not at all. They don't understand the complexity. And so I have this whole thing about myths of the network, that the network is free, you know, all the same things we always talk about. The network is free. You can throw as much traffic as you want to at it. It never drops traffic. It always delivers traffic on time. There's never such thing as a jitter. Packets aren't delivered out of order. All this other nonsense that application developers seem to believe about the network. And part of this, I think, is because we see the network. We've encouraged the view that the network is a perfect abstraction, that you throw packets at it and it delivers the packets no matter what. And we seem to forget that the network is a non-trivial abstraction and all non-trivial abstractions leak. And the network state is going to leak into your application. Sorry, but it just is.
Right. And I mean, I spend a lot of time talking to teams, for instance, that are in the process of migrating to Kubernetes or and what is Kubernetes really? I mean, it's literally a new container overlay on top of a new paradigm for networking, right? It's in essence nested networking, and a new concept for storage and a new concept for CPU allocation and a new concept for all these other things. And you know, it can be difficult for people to sort of understand, like, you are now forced to encounter DNS problems, whereas before maybe that was not a thing that you had to deal with because the whole system runs on DNS, as sort of a micro example. And yeah, I think that that's entirely fair. And I think that, like, cloud providers in general, and I like the cloud, and you know, I certainly don't want to go back to a world where I'm constantly racking new servers in a data center that's 110 degrees waiting for Dell to ship me some equipment. But, you know, at the same time, it can be difficult. I think people are genuinely surprised, for instance, when you explain to them, like, availability zones in at AWS are physical data centers, right? Like, so yes, of course there's jitter going between A and B because it's a physical connection, a fiber connection between two physical sites. And, you know, you have to start talking about speed of light and you start talking about all those other things. And I think that, like, that sort of adds to sort of a micro example of, like, how we attempt to hide complexity, but at some point and at a certain scale, you're forced to encounter and work through it.
So what do you think has changed recently that makes this harder than it used to be? It's not just that the cloud came along. I don't think that by itself made things harder.
The point that my article tries to make is that, like, I think developers are naturally really curious. And I think that, like, in general, most of the application developers I've worked with have been really intellectually stringent and sort of deeply sort of curious and interested in the technology. But the modern workflow and the focus on features, specifically getting features out the door as quickly as possible, from a modern business perspective, has really robbed them of a lot of the time and incentive to maybe do the deep dives that used to happen. Because I used to remember that, like, application developers pivoting to infrastructure or pivoting to database administration or whatever, like, used to be something that happened with some regularity. And now it seems like you come on to a team, maybe you have some Node experience or some general JavaScript experience, or a framework, right? You know, you're the Rails person or whatever. And you come on and you're sort of expected to ship X number of features a month. And there just isn't a lot of time in the modern, constantly shipping, you know, the CI/CD means that, like, what is a release day really at this point? It just seems that there's no time or capacity in this pipeline, I think, for people to sit down and say, like, how does this work? Can you walk me through it? Can we sit down? Can I do a rotation on your team and get those answers and that deep dive knowledge? It just seems to be a pattern that's fallen out of favor. I think it's a shame.
And at the same time, it's more important that we understand the whole stack. So at the same time, we're having cycles sucked away from us to understand the whole stack. It's becoming more and more important that we do understand the whole stack, I think, is one thing that I got from the article.
Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, it's especially must be so frustrating to start as a developer in 2021, have tools like Docker, everything works amazingly on your laptop, and then, you know, you push it out, it's a disaster, and you're like, why did this happen? And someone has to be like, let me explain to you what hot proxy is. Let me explain to you what levels layer 7 load balancing is. And I would be like, oh my God, like that's information overwhelming. Like, I don't know what to do with that. So I agree.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because again, that comes back to abstraction to some degree, but it also comes back to the agile process to some degree as well. Like you said, we are trying to iterate as quickly as possible, bring up features. We have a feature orientation. And there's a lot of good things about data-driven, but there's bad things about data-driven as well. And one of the bad things about data-driven is we just go wherever the data takes us. We don't have a goal, an ultimate goal a lot of times. Our only goal is follow the data. Yeah, awesome. But what if the data takes you down 14 little squirrel paths? Well, that's okay. We're still following the data. So we're following our goal. But we don't have an end goal of what we intend this application to look like, what problem we intend for this application to solve. And so it becomes more about go to the user base, find what problem they're facing today with my application, fix that problem, and get it fixed, get it shipped, and then move on to the next. And by the way, I see people build networks this way too. I mean, I know companies who do this. They just say, well, there's this problem. I'm going to try writing this bit of code and implement this new protocol or do this thing in QoS or filtering or whatever, and I'm just going to throw it out there, and if it works, I'm going to leave it. And there's no real concept of architecture or goal or, like, what am I trying to get done?
Yeah, and I think that part of it is that it used to be possible, right, relatively early in my career, to say that an application was complete, right? Like, that this application is, for the most part, feature complete. That isn't really true anymore. Like, if you are still accepting investor money, especially, like, there is an expectation that even if the market doesn't really ask for it, even if your customers aren't necessarily clamoring at the door, new features means new sales cycles, right? It means an opportunity for your sales team to re-engage customers or, you know, potential customers and say, you turned us down last time, but, like, you know, hey, we've added whatever new sort of feature or flag. And I think that, like, that is a bit of an unsustainable pattern, because as everyone learns who does this for a while, right, leaving features, even with good test coverage, isn't free, right? If I have a ton of features inside my application framework, upgrading becomes harder, working inside that code base becomes harder. And so then you get sort of trapped in a cycle where you're like, well, maybe we'll do microservices to solve the problem of my framework being too complicated. And this complexity sort of grows on itself. And I think that, like, the application developers are so pressed for time now because of this pressure from the top, from this methodology, that, you know, they just don't have the time to sit down or sort of the incentives to sit down and learn some of this. Yeah. You know, they're just so desperate for me to make the CI/CD error go away.
And I think part of it too is something else you bring up in your article is the killing off of the QA team.
I'm very upset about that.
And how that impacts the developer's job, because... And not only the dumpster fire that a lot of software is nowadays. I mean, it just is. I was reading an article the other day, and I think we might want to try to get the author of this article on, talking about this other article I was reading about. Oh, the software industry needs to be held accountable. They need professional certifications where they can be held accountable for writing bad code and just screwing things up. I mean, people are starting to die now because hospitals crash. And, like, that's just unacceptable at this point in our lives, you know? That's got to stop. And I think that's related partially to the killing off of QA, right? We don't do quality assurance anymore. We do sys test sometimes. Sometimes we don't. Now, I know I work for a vendor. We do unit test and sys test. But by and large, you're right. I mean, the coder is responsible for getting the code to work correctly on their own. There's no oppositional testing. It's all what the coder writes. And so, you know, there's this kind of weirdness in our culture now about the lack of QA and the lack of quality, just the lack of quality in the code that we see out there. And I think you're right. Part of that was to ship software more often. We just want to increase the velocity of change.
Yeah. And I mean, I love test-driven development. I think that it's a huge benefit. Who doesn't enjoy the endless stream of green checkboxes as you go through your CI/CD system? But it's really difficult to do actual web end-to-end Selenium, you know, like browser-based testing. Browser-based testing has always been a disaster, and it remains a disaster. I mean, like, you know, the DOM is just not a reliable target for things like, you know, writing concrete testing against. And this was something that QA departments were really good at, because they had the time and the capacity to sort of sit down and learn, like, we are going to get really good at this. We're going to ensure that, like, the software doesn't regress. And it just has sort of turned into this sad thing where we sort of all believed at one point that, like, it was acceptable for developers to become the ones who ultimately had to do this enormous amount of work that used to be a totally separate department. And we said, like, automated testing is sufficient to cover all possible error cases. And that was never true. And it may be true if you're dealing with only an API, but if you're dealing with a service that interacts with the end user across 800,000 browser versions and different operating systems and mobile, and you know, that was just never a realistic thing. And I think we set it just so that we could justify removing those headcount, but also really placing a focus on, like, stop talking about testing so much, just get the feature out the door.
Yeah, feature velocity becomes our actual goal. Again, change for change's sake. We just want to get the change out there and make it happen. And whether or not people use it, or even if they do use it and it's a good thing they're using it, well, if it crashes every now and again, oh well. Yeah, and I think that's the aggressiveness, you know, move fast and break stuff. And we don't think about the damage we're doing in the break stuff part of that equation. And also something else you said here was really interesting is about the muddling of ownership when this happens. No one owns anything anymore. It's like that old saw about everybody and somebody. There's that old story about everybody will do it, but nobody does it because somebody else is going to do it or whatever. Tragedy of the commons. And I think that's a very big problem as well. Everybody ends up owning everything, and therefore nobody ends up owning anything, and nothing gets done in many cases.
Matthew, what have you seen in... I'm interested in, like, a practical example. So I get how this would happen, that if everybody owns it, there nobody does. But can you think of a specific time when the ownership, like, really led to a big problem that could have been prevented with ownership?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, the perennial example that comes to me is I was working for Fortune 500 company, and, like, often these things happen, right? We have product A, which is, like, you know, it's used by all of our customers, but we have decided to deprecate it. And then we have product B, which is going to be our new product. It's going to have all the new amazing features. You know, we are going to fix all the mistakes we made the first time, right? This is the sort of dream of the perennial greenfield project where you're like, this time I'm going to do it right. And decisions were made sort of arbitrarily over the course of the process to say, like, these really difficult to implement legacy features are just going to get dropped. Right. And no one took ownership of saying, I'm going to sit down with sort of the customers that are affected by this and determine, like, whether or not that's true. And then there was also things about, like, determinations about, like, how Postgres, for instance, would work. How could you ship wall around the world? Right. And part of it was that we just all assumed, or this team just assumed, that, like, at some point we would be able to bring in a DBA or a series of DBAs that would be able to come up with sort of this magical wall shipping paradigm that would allow us to do everything that we wanted to do. It would be like Postgres, but Cassandra. It was going to be amazing. And no one really raised the question. We were all just sitting there. You'd see the slide and you'd be like, I assume that someone has sat down and sketched that out and done an architectural diagram and knows that that will work. And then you get further up to launch date and you're like, oh my God, nobody did that. I also see it a lot in terms of migrations to Kubernetes, where people are like, you know, I think the classic example is, like, we have an old app, we need someone to containerize it, and then everyone stops talking, right? Because no one wants to do it. Nobody wants to sit down and figure out, like, how do I compile the legacy library that we used for this, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, everyone's like, well, the other one should be easy. So, like, someone will get that one, or eventually we'll move that one in, even though it's absolutely critical, but nobody wants to touch it. I think that those are the ones that sort of pop to mind the earliest or the fastest for me.
I agree. Ownership of something, it kind of goes along with the misaligned incentives point, I think, a little bit. When something is yours and you know it's yours and everyone else knows it's yours, generally things get taken care of pretty well. I think it's just human behavior. But when nobody owns anything, That's my experience as well. Mistakes like this, architectural mistakes get made, but even operational mistakes happen because of it.
Operational mistakes. And I think that like the best example to me of modern services is like with the old monolith design, a team always owned the monolith, right? But with microservices, that's not true because they are supposed to be sort of self-contained, magical things of code. And so what you start to see is you start to see drift, right? And you see drift in language and design and paradigms and, you know, what type of API are we going to present, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that's something where it turns into one of those Death Star, right? That's the sort of famous example where you're like, it's the Death Star of microservices. And now we can't figure out like how the application works anymore because the graph is too complicated.
And because teams no longer own it, they don't have to maintain it. So I remember sitting in a meeting talking about network management systems at a large company. And there was a 3-day meeting just going through a spreadsheet and looking at all the little scripts and little things that people had written to do specific things to manage the network. And with every one of these things, somebody would say, so does anybody use the script anymore? And somebody would say, well, I think Joe over in DevOps someplace, over in some other team might still be using that. We can't really get rid of it. Well, who maintains it? Blank looks all around the table. Nobody knows, right? Because you've written it. It's sitting in the network. People are using it, but nobody thinks that, oh, I own this, so therefore I need to maintain it. Or a team doesn't own it. It was somebody wrote it as a one-off. Then they left the company. And everybody's like, well, that's really useful. I'm going to keep using that. But nobody understands the code and nobody's maintaining it. And someday it's going to break and everybody's going to go sitting around the table going, well, who takes care of it? I guess the person who gets hurt the most when it breaks.
Right. I mean, like a great example earlier in my career, right, was like I was doing a rotation on an application development team. And this team was very big into microservices, very big into, you know, Lambdas, AWS sort of setup, which I thought was great. And I was like, I really want to get my hands dirty. And they were like, can you take a look at this microservice? And this person had decided, apropos of nothing, even though this was a Rails company, everything was written in Ruby and Rails. They're like, we're going to do this in Haskell. And I was like, I don't know Haskell. And like, I don't know how to maintain Haskell. I don't know. I was like sitting there and I was like, why did this happen? And the answer is because like sometimes these people just like, when you have this sort of very hands-off approach to every single design, sometimes people are just like, well, what's interesting for me to do right now? Or sort of what's trendy right now? And I see a lot of that with Rust as well, which I love, but I'm also like a little bit afraid, like in 5 years, if sort of the enthusiasm has fallen out of that community a little bit, like, are we going to be left with like a whole bunch of like compiled Rust sitting places? And we're all going to be like, God, I hope like someone remembers how this works.
Or even as the source code and not just the compiled binary.
I mean, sometimes with DevOps teams, you find just Go binary is called like production 01. And you're like, oh, Jesus, like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah. And you just don't know. Right. Exactly. And so I think it's interesting how you run down this thing as well about GitOps and how we have this competing thing between digitization of companies and the idea of going faster and opening up, right? And part of this is driven by the data driving again, right? I mean, there's Kai-Fu Lee's virtuous cycle. I want to have more data, so I get more engagement of the user. The user gives me more data, which allows me to engage the user, you know, and this whole concept of more data, more data, more data versus be more secure and be more reliable. And we don't somehow see that those two things are often at odds with one another, that, you know, these are actually competing. They're not necessarily complementary in the way that we think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is your classic example that everyone does, right? Which is you make a Terraform repo, you say everyone's allowed to deploy to production who applies to this Terraform repo. Something catastrophic happens to like your VPC or something, right? And you say, never mind, not everyone can deploy to production from the Terraform repo. And you know, it's not the fault of anyone in particular, but it's like this idea of if we all work together and we sort of lower the gates, right? It turns out bad things can still happen. And I think the old design, which was much more isolated, there are sysadmins here, there are network operations here, there are database administrators here, there are maybe, if you're very big, right, you have like a SAN engineer or something sitting over there buying hard drives and collecting them, because that's all I know about SANs. And you know, I think that that model, while it did slow down progress, right, it sort of ensured a level of expertise as you step through the stack. And I think that operations teams right now are facing like sort of this impossible situation where I've never had less control about what runs in my infrastructure, but I've also been never been held to such a high standard. Are we completely up to date? Are we completely secured? Can we pass a pen test? Can we pass a full AWS security audit? Are we, you know, there's all these new sort of paradigms, and customers have gotten so smart too that they ask for independent audits. They ask for much more detailed security analysis than they've ever asked for before, which is great, and customers should keep that up. But it's really put an operations team in a hard place where I'm like, I don't really have a lot of the tools to say no like I used to. Things can go out to production with less approval than they have ever had before, but my work is also being held to a much higher standard. And I think that that tension has caused a lot of animosity between the two groups, developers and operations, where they didn't have to be before.
I think the incentives comes in here a lot, and you mentioned this in your article, but there are almost no incentives for securing a system or making sure that it passes an audit. Nobody ever gets any sort of recognition or a bonus or anything because they passed an audit. But if you miss it, you're sure going to hear about it.
Exactly. And I think that some of the best developers I've worked with over my life have been people who are really focused on stability and refactoring and really taking applications and sort of working them through. And this is true of operation teams as well, right? And creating that tooling, making it more reliable, or making it more repeatable. And it's a shame because, again, it's that incentive thing where you're like, these are great engineers who are not being pushed to the top of the leadership org chart because the work that they're putting out is not at all what business wants to see. And it's just, I think it's like sort of an unsustainable pace.
Yeah. And by the way, this is not just a problem in DevOps and application development stuff. We can take this to the broader community as well. People really complain about the glacial pace of things like the IETF and the ITU and writing standards and W3C and on and on and on. But they don't understand that when you increase the speed at which one of these organizations works, what you have to do to increase that speed is to reduce the checks. And sometimes those checks are purely political and they're completely right. Those checks should be taken out. And I hit all the time, I hit political stuff in the IETF that just drives me crazy. But on the other hand, there is wisdom in the people who have been working on these things for 20 or 30 years, opening up the bag of stuff that you're trying to deploy in a network and saying, that just ain't going to work. You know, that's just not going to work. And I'm sorry to slow you down. And I know you think it's going to work. But the fact is, that's going to work for about 2 days and then it's going to crash. And you may not be here 2 days when it does crash, but it's going to.
I completely agree. And I, you know, one of the more exciting opportunities I had in my career was to work with a team of C developers all in their 40s and 50s who worked for a high frequency trading firm in Chicago. And I sort of got to sit with them for 2 weeks. And it was fascinating to see this methodology where they're like, we cannot make mistakes. It is billions of dollars at risk. We would much rather not push out code. You know, and like, it was a very different ideology, right? Their network team was like, we are aware of the firmware that is loaded on the NICs in our servers. We know we compile our own Linux kernel because we have specific optimizations around the TCP stack that we're looking for. And it was this incredibly fine-grained level of control. And I was just sort of in awe. I was like, this is a level of expertise that just doesn't, you know, most organizations just don't have in their repertoire. And it's sort of a shame. But also that like that amount of experience is so valuable. I can sit down with a developer who's been doing this for 25 years and say, like, what are the problems I'm going to run into? Or a network operations engineer and be like, how is this going to break? And they're going to be like, XYZ, right? The ISP that you chose is a crap, it's Hurricane Electric, it's a crap ISP. Like, you're going to have problems or whatever. You know, these are sort of the examples. Yeah. So I agree with you. I think it's like sort of it applies all over the spectrum.
Yeah, it does. It does. And one thing you talk about in your article a lot is the idea of rolling back and how we just think that we can fix anything. We can deploy it. And if we don't like it, we just undeploy it.
Right. Facebook rollback, right? BGP, you can just roll back.
Yeah. Only it takes a while to converge.
Turns out when you tell the internet not to send traffic to those IP addresses anymore, it's hard to get to the data center.
And it takes a while for the internet to figure out that that actually wasn't what you meant to say.
Yep. The process.
So, yeah, it's a process. And rolling back doesn't always work. That's right. It doesn't always, you can't just always roll back. Sometimes there's a ratcheting one-way effect and it just, you know, you've made a decision. I mean, my daughter always says, good decision makers make a decision. If they don't like the result, they make a different decision. And that is true, but sometimes the decision you make impacts or narrows the range of future options. So you can make another decision, but you may not have the same decisions after you've made the first decision available. Like the options may not be there anymore.
Yeah. And like the classic example that we used to use, right, is we used to say, you say that your organization is agile. You say that your organization can roll back. Like, let's say that you have an outage, right, that causes the loss of customer data, right? I need to fail over a database and like they're not in sync, right? How open is your organization to that data loss? Like, how critical is that replaying that, right? And we have examples from all over the industry, right? GitHub, when they had their sort of long outage a while ago, was like, we would rather continue to be down and not lose customer data, right? Than, you know, sort of accept the loss of all those Git commits and move on with our lives. But I think that if you are that kind of organization, you have to be honest with yourself and say, like, infrastructure, that means you can't really fully roll back infrastructure, right? That this stuff, once committed, once pushed out into the world, has a real operational cost for you. And if you are the kind of organization that can just throw away customer data, then you're fine. But in my experience, that's few and far between.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I think this covers the ground pretty good. I mean, you know, at the end of the article there, you talk about, like, I really love this image you have of somebody sitting there with a lemonade squeezer and all these lemons are being shot at them with this big gun. And it's like, yeah, if life hands you lemons, make lemonade, but there's only you and one lemonade squeezer, man. And there's only so much lemonade you can make before you just like give up and say, okay. So, yeah, I mean, I think what the points you make here are very good. You know, it's that testing an application on a laptop and hitting a go to production button works until it doesn't. Somebody always has to own the gap. Somebody always has to own this stuff. And the lesson there is we need to go back to some form of ownership and not just assume that because it deploys and it works, it's going to work forever. I think that's a huge takeaway. So, Matt, anything else you want to chase up?
No. It was a pleasure to chat with you all. I've really been happy with the response the article has gotten over the internet. And a big thank you to all the nice folks on Hacker News and Twitter for not being threatening or whatever. I wasn't sure what the reaction was going to be. So I'm glad it worked out.
So Matt, tell us about where people can get in touch with you.
Absolutely. My website is mattduggan.com, mattduggan.com. I am Duggan_Matthew on Twitter. And if you want to see where I post stuff, we have an RSS feed. The website is ad-free. So just check me out at mattduggan.com.
All right. Awesome. And Tom, where can people get in touch with you?
I am on LinkedIn and Twitter. You can search for Tom Ammon and you'll find the right person.
Okay. I'm Russ White. You can always find me here at The Hedge on rule11.tech, LinkedIn, and well, wherever else you can find me. Who knows? Thanks, Matt, for coming on. Thanks, Tom, for hanging out with us. Yep, and we'll catch you next time on The Hedge.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.